I don't wanna go to work. I just wanna chill and play all day. Look him dead in the face and say, I wish I could just be still asleep while you work.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Jobs Blow podcast with Brianna and Josh.
The podcast for dreamers with and without day jobs.
We're so glad to be back after a year. We are, 10 episodes in, and we're just looking forward to sharing more and more inspiring stories, as well as perspectives on surviving life in, during, around, and now still during a pandemic.
Well, I changed that to hopefully after a pandemic.
No, I changed it back to still during.
Okay. Well, anyway, I decided to keep my inspirational quote a segment alive. So today's quote is, I chose this one for you specifically, Josh.
For me? Okay, yes. Go.
It's better to risk starving to death than surrender. If you give up on your dreams, what's left? And it's by a famous comedian.
Starving to death, I'm thinking it's... maybe he was really heavy. Is it?
He wasn't heavy. He wasn't
Rodney Dangerfield.
No, he wasn't heavy. But he was somebody who had like $0 at one point, and then got $1 million.
Oh, check. So every comedian? Okay.
No, then he got $1 million.
$1 million check. He
had actually written himself one at one point in his
Ray
career.
Romano.
No, Jim Carrey.
Oh, it's so crazy that you say that because I can't believe I didn't know that. I did that. I at one point wrote myself a check for a certain, not $1 million, but I'm not kidding. It happened. Like, it took a couple of years, but like, I wrote myself a check for a certain number, and through different means and different productions I did, and working my ass off, like four jobs at a time with a kid, I actually ended up making it. That's crazy that you even, good for you. Thank you.
What do you mean good for me? I didn't make $1 million.
No, but how crazy is that? I'm saying Rodney Dangerfield and all this stuff, and it was that quote, except it wasn't $1 million. Maybe I should have shot higher.
Maybe. You probably should have.
Well, how are you, Brianna? What's going on with you?
I'm fine. I don't have anything new to report in my life. Wow. I was looking at airfare to Ohio to finally visit my family, and I'm really annoyed because I thought like I'd finally get a deal. Because going there and spending over $300 on a ticket per person is really frustrating.
Sure.
Because there are so many other places I'd like to vacation.
And no, yes.
And no, the tickets are back up to over $300 a person, which is almost, it's like $1,000 for three people.
Why don't you drive? No?
It's 10 hours. And by the time you rent a car, it's kind of the same, you know.
Do you know where I almost drove this weekend? To Lincoln, Nebraska. Last weekend, because they had the Ultimate Josh Showdown.
I saw that. A little boy won.
Everybody thought it was a joke, and it turned out all these people named Josh showed up to kick the shit out of each other with pool noodles. Could you imagine how much fun that would? I bet you that was so fun.
Yeah, I don't understand how a four-year-old wins, though.
They let him win. They probably smacked him around, and then, you know, someone just let him, you know.
I don't know. It's Nebraska. You know, anytime those flyover states, I don't trust anything that goes on there.
I was talking shit on the Facebook page to people. I'm like, everybody's going down. I tie shoelaces faster than anybody in this country. Double bunny ears, motherfuckers. People with the full streams of like, you're going down with my loop around. It was like the funniest shit ever, dude. It was so. I wish I knew about it.
I wish I knew about it.
I would have gone. Anyway, let's get our chit chat going today because we have a cool guest.
Yes. So our guest comes to us through a friend, my friend Jennifer Rosenzweig. Winograd.
What's up, Jennifer Rosenzweig? Winograd.
She's just Jennifer to me. But anyway, she is an avid listener of this podcast. And she recommended her friend who's here today. His name is Jeremy Neuberger, and he is a satirist, Emmy-winning director, and CEO of Ironbound Films. And today's show is called Woke But Satired. And, you know, you'll get it as we talk. But anyway, welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, guys. Nice to be here.
Thanks for being here. How's it going? How you feeling?
I feel pretty good. COVID was a wake-up call for me, not because I got COVID, because I was diagnosed with diabetes.
What?
During COVID.
Yeah. What? That's bad timing.
So let's let's get into your crazy, your work and the Twitter and everything
earlier, which is I wanted to just raise this amusing aside about it. I declared myself a satirist on Twitter when I was writing my bio. I said, you know what? I make political satire on Twitter, so I'm a political satirist. And I just left it there. And all of a sudden, when your tweets get noticed, they publish them in, you know, let's say...
Oh, yeah, I found you in articles. People include your stuff.
My tweets get published very often, and they'll say, political satirist Jeremy Hugenberger. And I'm sitting over here going, yeah, well, I gave myself that.
See, once again, Josh, what do we learn? We need to lie on our resume.
We need to just lie.
Can I tell you something? Everybody I know, and I know people who blatantly lie about different things on their resume, are successful, making tons of money. It is such a farce if you can't get your ass out of your own way, man.
So Google is currently reviewing. There's a search team at Google that they look into things to decide whether they can label this, that, the other thing. And because I started collecting these articles that called me a political satirist, I said, hey, Google, in the little blurb about me, you're calling me a filmmaker, which is true. I've made films, but you don't know I'm also a political satirist. Here's the Jerusalem Post. They called me a satirist. Here's Newsweek. They called me a satirist. Jesus. By the way, the word satire is from the Latin word for like full. Did you know that?
Okay. Full.
You're just full. You had like a lot to eat. So I feel like a satirist all year. But it's just funny. I'm waiting for Google to decide whether or not they think I am actually a satirist. And I said lying before. I don't feel like I'm lying. Like, I do write political satire.
Right.
Whether or not you want to put me on on the Mount Rushmore of political satire, that's certainly for audiences to decide in 100 years. But I think I could certainly back up the title and write.
Well, and also, topics. And also when your next descriptor is Emmy Award winning director, that it helps. It really helps.
I must correct you. I never won an Emmy. I was nominated.
Emmy nominated. Yeah. Okay.
It doesn't mean so much, but I just, you know.
That's pretty exciting.
You know what?
I don't know that I've ever been nominated for an award.
The Emmys are really exciting, but not the Emmys that I was nominated for. News and documentary Emmys. That's Christina Amanpour is walking around with like a gin and tonic.
She's badass.
It's not at the actual Emmys. It's like 3 months earlier at the ballroom.
Yeah, but this is the stuff that matters. So let me ask on that note, is this your dream job, what you're doing? When you were little, is this the dream you had? Or is this the dream, did it evolve into this dream?
All right, so yes and no. I'll give you a yes and no. Here's the yes. When I was very, very young in high school, I saw Michael Moore's Roger and Me, a documentary about GM being evil bastards. You guys both identified hating corporate entities. This film was like a real calling out of a corporation being, evil and destroying Michigan. And yet it was like brilliantly funny. And that movie inspired me to become a documentary filmmaker. But I was like, too young. I didn't even know how to fold pants. I was not ready to do anything.
Right.
But I kind of kept that as my dream and vision. I'm going to become a filmmaker. And I ended up following the path of filmmaker, at a couple different colleges until I found the right, path. And then working my way up the ladder until I eventually became a filmmaker. So the answer is yes, in that I'm one of those few lucky people who, when they were a little kid, said, I want to do X. And I'm doing X. Now, the no is what I really wanted to do was write for Saturday Night Live. Mm. I wanted to write political satire for Saturday Night Live. I'm not doing that. So I have not achieved that dream. I feel like the Twitter side of my, life is where I get that kind of out of my system.
Well, so that's interesting because my friend, Jennifer, you met while you were pages at NBC. So
job to blow.
But you had your foot in the door, so to speak, right?
Well, so, in the most like literal sense, we were like, opening doors for people like in the hallway to walk.
Right, right. But they always, I mean, the line is like, that's where you start. Now, SNL, maybe not, you know, that maybe not. I don't know any writers that necessarily started as a page. Yeah. But you just came to some point where you're like, all right, this isn't how I'm going to get there. So I'm leaving.
No, I kind of, you know, it's funny. I always tell people that there's this kind of chart that, you know, it's what you're kind of what you're good at chart. And then there's a chart of like, you know, what your occupational dream is. Mm-hmm. And they're both kind of going. And when they crisscross, that's when you found your career. So I was kind of going with the flow. I got in as an intern on Conan O'Brien when the late show with Conan O'Brien was watched by zero people. And you know, that was an exciting job for me, though, wanting to be a writer on Saturday Night Live. It was getting closer. And as a result of interning there, they opened up the door of the page program to me, where I met Jennifer Rosenzweig, who is a doll, by the way. We used to call her Tex.
Yes.
Just that's what happens to you if you're in New York and you're from Texas. And the page program, I struggled through it because I was really good as a page. Like, I'm a naturally good tour guide. I can tell you, you know, I can make people feel really good about being in Jane Pauley's studio. I'm just like fucking brilliant at that. I can just, you know, you'll vision Jane Pauley over there, the coldness of the air. I can just bring it to life. But like, that's not going to get me anywhere in life. So that's a job that blows. I was in like a polyester uniform giving, you know, like that kid from 30 Rock, giving tours. I gave a tour of the Saturday Night Live studio once to a group of, I guess, what's the politically correct way of saying this? I guess, slow adults. I think that's the right way to say it.
Challenged? Were they mentally challenged?
Yeah, mentally challenged adults. And the elevator ride made one of them sick, and they vomited in the hallway of Saturday Night Live, and then all of them vomited.
Oh,
and
my God.
And they get on like a phone on the wall.
And oh, I remember my God. Tom
Brokaw was like stopped to see what was going on. He was there at the time. And I was like, hi, I'm on Studio 8H hallway. We need a crew up here quick. You know? That was like,
that's terrible. But that should have been your audition sketch.
Yeah, that right should have been, you should have been like, this is my skit. I've brought it to life.
Yes. So that was a moment where I was like, holy shit, I'm never going to write for Saturday.
They do a lot of dick jokes. Nobody does a throw up joke on SNL.
Right, all right. But I'm saying to myself, like, I'm not going to write for this show. I'm like, you know, cleaning up puke in the hallway. This is too big of a divide. So, of course, I got recruited from the page program to work at MSNBC as a production assistant for IMS in the Morning. Who I only knew because my dad used to tell his jokes. And I found out where my dad's jokes were coming from.
Right.
Listening to, you know, on his squeaky AM radio in the bathroom loudly, you know, hey, I'm a from the Morning.
Well, that's so hysterical. If like, if I miss is telling a joke, you were there, and then you go see your dad that night, and he's like, I got a new one for you. Exactly. And you're like, you're a fraud, Dad.
All right. I found you out. So I did IMS for about 4 years. And the best thing about it was on MSNBC, and they were throwing him guests from NBC's political, intelligentsia. So Tim Russert was coming on, and, you know, senators like John Kerry and John McCain, and from both sides of the aisle, they were coming on the show. And there was a political humor, even though, you know, people our age never found him funny, that was being, you know, crafted on a daily basis. So I was able to kind of sharpen the creative knives, and I call it like, television school, the 4 years that I worked there. And I worked my way up to producer of that show, the IMS on MSNBC show. This was before he made his awful joke about, I think it was an African-American team.
Basketball team.
I was long.
Did he die? Is he dead now?
Yeah, he's dead. He's dead.
Yeah, I thought so.
But I was long gone before that shit happened. Thank God. I got the sense from hanging in the proximity of him that he was someone who would say the N-word without any, you know, problems.
Well, as we're learning, that's the case for many people that are now very comfortable with.
Right. So
I always find it so interesting when people argue on social media about, well, why can't I say the word? Or why can't I sing it in a song? I'm like, if you have to ask that question, Like I have no interest in saying that word. There's not even a part of me that wants to say that word.
Right. No, that's not the word I want to say. There's other ones though I'd like to say. To be honest, I think the woke thing is now becoming kind of like a parody of something that is important.
Mm-hmm.
I think it becomes like an easy thing for like the right-wing media to kind of like pigeonhole as like, oh, now the left is all woke. Versus now the left wants to, you know, save the whales.
Or hold us accountable. Like that's their way of now getting out of being accountable for anything.
The problem is that since that disastrous Trump was president, there's been a rise in, you know, hate crimes against Asian people. There's been a rise in anti-Semitism. There's been a rise in, you know, a shooting of Black people. These are like real things that are happening. So you can dismiss, you know, woke culture, but at the same time, it's like it's in response to the genie of racism getting not only out of the bottle, but getting into Congress and getting elected president and being in federal, you know, DOJ jobs and police stations around the country. So that's to me, you know, that sort of rings out when I'm hearing kind of woke thrown around a little bit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
And just to, for our audience too, like you focus mostly on political satire, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not just everything. It's you really get the politics is what lights your fire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's accurate. I think it's just what I ended on because I'm like a movie guy. I would be making movie jokes or, you know, jokes about the Oscars, but I found like there's different kinds of satire, you know, and I feel like if I can help move the needle with my jokes, then I'm feeling like I'm not just being a
friend. Right. You know, well, it's a good thing to talk about because from someone who writes jokes and tried to be a comedian and have those times where like you're just relying on jokes at work and you're not really pushing yourself, especially during the pandemic and the end of the Trump era, I was really firing this fire. When I got something in me, I hit it. I had a couple of really great jokes that did well out in the Twitter and Facebook sphere, you know.
Yep.
So explain maybe to people, especially since you're doing it so many times a day, what that sensation is like of like finding, you know, really hitting it on the head and that, you know, that you like, oh, that's a good one. I got to put that out there.
I made a joke at the first Women's March. I can't even remember what the joke was. I apologize. I add Alzheimer's to my diabetes.
Great.
I can't remember my own humor even. But if you look me up and you look up the Women's March, there's a joke that had like 150,000, you know, likes, and it was being amplified on Facebook, which I don't do Facebook because my mom writes in all caps.
Good job, Jeremy.
Yeah, it would be like I'd be at like a comedy club and she'd be in the front row, you know, screaming, "That was really funny!" You know, and I just can't on Facebook. So on Twitter, it gets brought over to Facebook and it just like pops viral. And I'm sitting there watching the, you know, thing scroll of like people responding and replying and all that. And I'm seeing people like, you know, it wasn't Streisand, but like people of that caliber retweeting and that kind of thing. And I was just like, holy shit.
Right.
This is like when I used to go to one of the Native American casinos, you know, in college.
Right.
Like you crank it and you hit like three cherries.
Right.
That's what the shit fall out.
I won $12.
It has that kind of feel to it. Right. And it just makes you hungry to achieve that again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at a point now where like if I get three likes on a tweet, then I know you said before, that's like great for me. If I get three likes, that means God, I just fucking flopped. I just bombed at the like Caroline's Comedy Club. Right.
You're spoiled now. You get 150 on a tweet, right. You're spoiled.
No, but so I have to average a certain amount for me to be content that I, you know, made a good joke. And then I'm also kind of like, well, you know what? I never said I was a comedian. Like, can I write something about my daughter's, you know, haircut and, you know, get 10 likes and just be happy, you know, a guy on the internet?
And so, wait, but are you?
But you also do observations. Like, you know, you one of the tweets, the most recent ones was about the New York Post article. I mean, you don't always come at it from kind of a place of satire. You know, you just put out your observations.
Right. I'm like, I'm angry at the influx of neo-Nazis and white supremacists. Right. And I think a lot of my anger, like I could just sit on Twitter being an angry person saying, "You Nazis," you know, like that woman in Marathon Man, you know that movie, when she recognizes the Nazi in the street and she's like, "Sal, I know that man." Like I can be right. that person. But the only way that it's going to like move the needle or be effective is if I add humor to it.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time kind of analyzing these right-wing media figures on, you know, Fox News and OAN and, you know, Newsmax and the things they're saying, and sometimes politicians, when it leans either racist or Nazi or white supremacist, which seems to be a lot. Like Tucker Carlson is on Fox News and the guy is advocating replacement theory. This is shit I like learned about in college, you know, when I read like the Turner Diaries.
Right.
And, you know, white supremacists.
Yeah, he's been getting worse lately too.
It's getting like really bad. So I find like that's when my sort of humor knives come out. But if it's not funny, then I just look at it later and I'm like, oh, I'm just.
But don't you feel like it comes out of like, it, you get that twinge of like, it, like, oh, it's like biting. You're like, I gotta say this. I have to, you know, like it jumps on you and you're like, I cannot not say this. So let me wordsmith it a little bit. Right. Yeah. I mean, like, and then my question is kind of like, how does that play into what is now obviously becoming your brand? Right. So people are coming to now look at your tweets to get that kind of humor. So if you turn around, like, for example, like I'll put a tweet out there or post on Facebook and maybe it's trying to be funny and it gets a couple of likes. But then like I'd put a thing of my kids on and all of a sudden it's like 200 likes. And but then I put something about Trump on and it's like 400 comments and fuck you and you fuck you. And it's like I'm all over the place. So for you as somebody who's like really now kind of building this brand there, like how do you kind of weed out what goes and what stays?
I don't think I'm as disciplined as that, Josh. Like I got a lot of replies and followers because I was likes and followers because I was replying during the Trump tweet age.
Okay.
To things he was saying in a very quick and witty way, and that's how I amassed like huge amounts of followers. But at the same time, I'm not as disciplined as that because at like 11:30 when I'm trying to like tweet myself to sleep, you know, I might make an observation about something non-political and just let it go. And I, you know, if I was like, I had a manager and I was like polished and I had, you know, I wouldn't, but sometimes those things get, you know, I'm developing like an audience of people who give a shit what I have to say.
It's like an ebb and flow too. Like you're like, here's a lot of this. Here's a little.
I'm not much to look at, but if I send a picture of myself out every once in a while, they're like, oh yeah, that's what that guy looks like.
Well, and I have to say there is something a little cathartic about, I would just get mad and go like, and there'd be a tweet by like Jim Jordan and I would just be like, you're a fucking asshole. And I would just feel so good about like feeling like he's going to see this tweet.
Right.
I just dislike this man so much.
But in terms of the documentary thing, I got lucky. I was a TV producer who was doing like cable news and I the writing was on the wall at some point that wasn't going to, you know, satisfy me. IMUS was not going to be my, like, you know, I didn't want to spend another minute listening to him talk about that ranch. He was ranch for the kids with cancer. So I jumped ship to like a production company. And then I had these two friends, Dan and Seth, who were making like, they were working their way up the ladder at a documentary independent, you know, film company. And I think they had fatigue with their sort of, you know, they were in someone else's company. They wanted to have their own thing. So they contacted me. I think I was hiring them to do projects for where I was working. And the three of us decided to join forces. And we joined together as Ironbound Films. That's my company.
Love it.
And like a month after I joined them, the grant that they had been like, you know, writing and laboring over from the National Science Foundation for like $500,000, like came in.
So oh, wow.
Like, that like slot machine again. I was like, woo!
College.
And that money went to making this kind of like real scrappy indie road film called The Linguists, which it follows Dave and Greg, these two, you know, they must've been in their like late 20s, early 30s when we followed them. They spoke like 30 languages between the two of them.
Wow.
Just like they could sit down and learn a language in like 5 seconds. Incredible. And we followed them to these like backwaters, you know, around the world in Siberia and Bolivia, you know, in India and like Orissa State, you know, into the tribal areas to find the lost language of, you know, whatever. And it was kind of like, it became like an Indiana Jones road trip comedy film, because they would get into like trouble or fight with each other. And we were kind of felt like fly on the wall filmmakers, just following them around. And we were real scrappy, the three of us. I was like, all of a sudden I was a camera guy, you know, you can't like bring a camera guy when you're driving 12 hours into the middle of like nowhere, you know, and you want to be real like nimble. So that film ended up going to Sundance. Yeah, so I was like, see, my first documentary is at Sundance. And that started a chain reaction where, you know, the next film was easier to, you know, find funding for. We got the Linguist ended up on PBS, and it was nominated for an Emmy. I did not win. We must say that. So that some like producer who did like episode of POV is not like, I won that year. But the documentary thing, just, we just ended up doing a film every year and a half, 2 years. And now we have like 8 movies, you know, collectively, the three of us. And we made a movie about Morton Downey Jr.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Wait. From the talk show guy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Morton, not Robert Downey Jr.
Morton Downey from like the 90s, the early 90s, late 80s.
Yeah, in the late 80s, he used to smoke, chain smoke cigarettes.
On TV, yeah.
Show in Secaucus, New Jersey, with like, it was the precursor of Jerry Springer.
Not and wild.
Didn't he get throat cancer or lung cancer?
Yeah, he died of lung cancer.
Yeah.
I said that so like happy. I was like, yeah, he died of lung cancer. Isn't that great? We made a, you know, a real rock and roll in your face documentary about his career, his show, which lasted like 2 years. It had Al Sharpton in a fist fight and Ron Paul and, you know, people like that getting screamed at. And it was like a real recipe for the Trump age. And it ended up, Magnolia picked it up. It was at Tribeca Film Festival. And then it aired on CNN, which is, I think, the biggest audience that any of my films have had to date. Yeah. With CNN. They did like they still do. They promote their docs like in between breaking news and other shit. Yeah. And it's just like, they just stay with it. And it aired on CNN like the same month that Trump came down the escalator. So announcing his candidacy. So it was perfect.
Which we all thought was a joke.
Right.
When he did that.
We all thought it was your next documentary that you were that you were filming.
Yeah.
So your next one that I think you had mentioned on your bio on Twitter is you have a punk documentary.
I do. Unfortunately, COVID sidelined it. We had just finished it. And the movie is about a punk band from Massachusetts, Marlboro, Massachusetts, called Color Killer. And these guys are, you know, super talented. It's a 4-piece band. And they were playing, they were one of the headliners at Warped Tour when it went through Massachusetts. That was like a huge punk traveling, punk alternative show. Oh, and by the way, they're ages 8 to 12. So
what?
It's like the little
Rappers
meets School of Rock meets, you know, the Ramones, you know. And they were just like hysterical quartet. And their parents were all their like road managers and shit. So, you know, they even had like this, one of the kids' dads, Tony, he's like the head real manager of the band. He reminded me of like Spinal Tap, of their manager.
Oh, that's funny.
Tony Hendra, I think, was the actor who played it. But the movie was finished and our plan was to launch it into the festival circuit. We usually go festival and then we find a buyer and then it airs on TV, you know, PBS or CNN or wherever. But COVID just took the wind out of the sails, and there's still, people are still not going to film festivals. So,
right. Well, they're online now and stuff. I mean, I had something in a festival and I signed in and watched all these films online.
Your enthusiasm for doing that.
Yeah, it's the least enthusiastic thing, I'll say.
Well, your poor movie's going to come out and these kids are going to be teenagers.
Right.
But from a storytelling, from a storytelling standpoint, though, I mean, what became more of the interest there to you? Was it the punk aspect or was it the kid aspect or the combo? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you're trying to find a hooks too of like, what's this weird, interesting thing that we could talk about, right?
Well, first off, punk is sort of a dying, you know, music form. So the fact that 4 kids who are like 8, 9, 10, 12 were trying their hand at punk was interesting on its own. But the sort of world of Look, I have older kids than that. I have a 16-year-old and a 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. The fact that these four sets of parents, instead of taking their kids to soccer practice, were taking them to like some shithole dive bar in like, you know, bumfuck Massachusetts at midnight to perform mm-hmm. for a bunch of tatted up, you know, nose ring weirdos. That's really fascinating.
Right. That's like, what I'm saying. If these kids were 25, yeah. it's not as interesting of a right. of a story.
I just think it's important to note here that my mom took me to the Holiday Inn when I was 10 and I sang Hit Me With Your Best Shot on stage because, yeah. And this was
at stage?
Yeah. Yeah. They had a band. I sang with them. Yeah. then the best part, she left me to spend the night with the band.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So like, you could have done a documentary on my life.
You still can. She's right here. You know,
I was once on stage with Harry Chapin when I was a little kid. And he asked if anyone had a song they want to sing. And I sang, my mom tells the story, I sang, you know, when you replace in Yankee Doodle Dandy, every letter of the alphabet, you sing, you know, with an A, then a B. Well, when you get to F, that's when I sang Yankee Doodle, stuck a feather in my hat. that was my big singing moment.
Aw, that's sweet.
So obviously, I mean, we know the answer, but also like from your perspective, like what's the kind of distribution you hope for that gets you kind of like, you know, the return on investment and the bigger yeah. reach and the nominations? Is it just the festival circuit? Is it HBO documentaries?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, what is it?
Multi-layered rollout of a film. So, and each of my films has had like different success to it. Mm-hmm. The Linguist ended up on PBS and was nominated for an Emmy. That's a great feather in your cap, and it's a great audience. PBS has a really intelligent, you know, solid fan base who come for documentaries, so that was a good place for that to be. And it was at Sundance. Unfortunately, it was our first film at Sundance, and you learn quickly that you're like a tiny little fish in a giant pond at Sundance, where there's, you know, 800 movies, you know, some of them are helmed by huge stars, and you really have to get people to notice you. And you hire a PR person and all that, and you're just trying to scream the name of your movie out loud so that someone hears about it. So we left Sundance without a buyer, and it was really just like an experience at Sundance. You know, a feather in her cap for sure.
Sure.
But we didn't come out of Sundance with like
What about with like streaming now? Is like Netflix the end result?
So when I had The Linguist, Netflix was like just an aggregator, and they were like, here's $8,000. We want your movie for 3 years. And I was like, okay. So that was... Now right. Netflix is like financing films and they're right. producing. So it's a different paradigm now. But yeah, I mean, all the places you've named, HBO, Showtime, Netflix, you know, Amazon, these are places that are showing content. And for sure, you want Woody Allen on HBO Max, or you watch, you know, one of the other big docs that are out right now. It's just sort of, you know, CNN was, I think I said before, the largest audience that a film of mine has ever had. And that is the end goal for a filmmaker. You want the biggest audience possible. So first, is the festival a good way to kind of introduce your film to the world? Second, do you get it sold and put on a television network or in theaters?
Right.
In theater films make tons of money if they're a success. Television, you know, gets you a little bit more renowned. Mm-hmm. And then of course, is it in window, you know, on TV and also on the internet at the same time, so people can watch it on Netflix. And I told you earlier, Roger and Me was one of my influences to go into sure. film. But I'm not Michael Moore. I'm far from it. And I think I've had success on CNN, and I've had success in the Jewish world with my baseball film. So sure. For sure, I tried to make a sequel to the baseball film because the same guys are on the Olympic team that's going to the Olympics.
Right. But
the Olympics got canceled and COVID killed all documentary films as we know.
And the Olympics. It killed everything. Literally.
So my best laid plans were destroyed this past year. So I'm trying to rebuild now, Josh. And I'll get back to you on what.
No, but I mean, you definitely have, right? Like you have the clout in those verticals there.
Yeah, I can't tell you where, but my punk film has found a home, and it's right. a good one. So,
oh, yay. That's exciting.
I'm not about to say where yet, but the film will come out probably in the late summer, and it's a pretty good place for it to go. So I'm excited.
That's great.
All right. I think it's important, Jeremy, for you to quickly tell your story about the FBI that you told me before Josh came along and before we started the interview, because I think it's an interesting take on having a voice in social media and the repercussions. And
oh, yeah, for sure. I made a comment on Twitter, as I oft do, that one Twitter follower did not care for. It had to do, I think, with January 6th, you know, the plans to, you know, go to the Capitol and cause trouble. I think it was before the attack on the Capitol. And I got a Facebook message, which is weird. No one messages me on Facebook. I told you before, I hate Facebook. And I'm on it just to see like pictures of people's kids and, you know, be a good bench to my family members. But the message was threatening. And then on Twitter, I discovered under my tweet, this guy was writing replies that I hadn't really noticed. And then I started reading them and they were naming my kids and my wife. And they were talking about, you know, shooting me with like a very specific kind of sniper weapon. So that elevated it to like, oh, this is a real death threat. And this guy's in New Jersey after I Googled to try and find him. Oh, and he has a criminal record. So I reported the tweets in a very compelling, you know, they give you this sort of, when you report a tweet, you know, show five tweets that you think prove your point. I was like, I got like 10, I could prove this point. But I made a pretty compelling case for Twitter to take this guy off Twitter. And simultaneously, I called the FBI and I made a report on this. This is the first time I've had to make an FBI report on someone. Then nothing happened for a day or two. The guy kept tweeting. And then he tweeted a picture of the FBI on his driveway, paying him a visit. And I see this because he's still on Twitter. And I was like, holy shit, this guy is like brazen. He does not care. And they're at his house and he's tweeting it. And then the FBI never contacted me to tell me what happened. But he mentioned in his tweet, you know, they told me to leave poor Jeremy alone. You know, obnoxiously, he said it like that. And then Twitter finally, like a week later, took him off Twitter. Wow. I was saying, like, what is the process? You know, what does it take to get someone off Twitter?
At that point, you want him on Twitter. You know where he is. You know where
Right. It's alarming, though. And like, you know, like the light goes on outside while I'm taking out the garbage and I see something in the tree and I'm like, oh, shit, is that the sniper? You know?
Yeah. It's terrifying.
My family wasn't happy about it. That's my wife. Was not happy.
No. It's terrifying. All right. It's
terrifying. That is the second scariest thing that happened to me this year in COVID. I don't know if you have the time and can indulge a quick story.
Okay.
So me and my wife were watching K-dramas on the couch and I get a text and I look at the text and it's a older woman, naked, completely naked. And her skin is sort of pale and she looks dead. And then a second picture comes in and it's like, there's no mistaking. This is a dead naked woman on a bed, you know, and it looks like a hotel room or whatever. And I'm like, you know, I have Twitter enemies. Maybe someone's fucking with me. You know,
right.
What is this? These are like, not like, you know, like a Sears portrait. This looks like some freaky, you know, person is taking these pictures. So I turned to my wife. I'm like, God, now I have to like share this with my wife. I'm like, honey, I have to tell you, I have dead naked women pictures on my phone and I don't know who this is from. And,
Jesus.
You know, so we agree that I should call the local police. So the police come, we're outside my house because of COVID, you know, distancing. And I'm like in the most awkward, you know, way trying to show him my phone with like dead naked women pictures on it. And like, he agrees that he promises me the cop, I will look into this and call you no matter what. I'm going to call you just to, you know, he could tell I freaked the fuck out. So my wife and I go back. We're like, how do you even like, you know, what do you do at that point?
Was there a number that it came from or was it?
Yeah, like, non-recognizable to me. I didn't never, you know, it was like,
did you call it? Did they call it?
So I didn't call it because I'm a chicken, but they called it. So the cop calls me and what happened? He says, listen, you're not going to believe this, but because of COVID, when there's a crime scene, they're not bringing in the, you know, the team, the mortician, you know, the forensic guy.
Oh my God.
So in a lot of cases, the detectives are having to take the crime scene photos with their own phone and then send it to them.
Oh my God. So those were actual crime scene photos? So
the detective accidentally, because he had the gloves and the protective gear on and COVID and all this, he pushed two digits off.
God.
To me. Now, wait a minute. This guy knew he fucking sent me these photos and he didn't like, you know, followed up with a text like, oh, I'm sorry. This is, you know, New York detective. He just let it go and hoped for the best. You know, I could have been like a 12-year-old kid. You know?
Oh my God. You
listen, that's bad and wrong, but like there's so much humor in that too. Yeah. Like you could have wrote back and be like, she definitely had an aneurysm. I don't know. What if you knew her?
I mean, oh my God. Cause
I have to tell you, I wrote like a 40 tweet thread that
tells about this.
Yeah, about the whole thing. And I'll have to send it to you after this. You'll enjoy it.
Oh, my God. That's all right. Well, on that
front. The scariest thing that happened to me in COVID.
Wait, real quick. What's the ideal length for a documentary? Is it an hour, hour 15?
I got to hit 80 to 90 minute marker for it to be long enough to be, you know, a feature. If you get under 65, it's a short. And 65 is a little too short for it to be in the theaters. So You hit that 80 to 90 is the sweet spot. But now, that's like already out of date. Now you want a 4-part, 6-part true crime doc series. So that's the sweet spot. You need 6 hours. And if you can't get 6, 4 will do.
Awesome.
All right.
Well, I think, do we want to ask 5 years? Real quick, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Definitely this house I'm in right now.
Okay.
I'm not going to be able to sell it. And I kind of like it. I just built this little kitchen nook into it where I'm there sitting. You go. And, it's got a nice big backyard and, you know, and
my still wife, doing documentaries, still yeah, tweeting I'm away.
I'm going to still do documentaries. I'm hoping to break the 100,000 Twitter follower mark. I'm getting close. I don't know what happens when that happens, but I'd like to see. I'll be doing the same thing. I love Dan and Seth, the two guys I make films with. We're not sick of each other yet. We still have a bunch of stories to tell. Cool. And I know older dude documentary and dudette documentary filmmakers, and they kind of keep going until they're like in their late 60s. So I got, you know, I got more than 5 years. I got another like 30 to go in terms of making films. So I'll just keep doing it until people, you know, hate me or I get canceled.
Well, why don't you tell everybody where to find you on Twitter and any other social handles?
Oh, so yes, my Twitter persona is my name, Jeremy Neuberger. And if you search me, you'll find me. And
spelled as sounding, Jeremy Neuberger.
Yeah. ER. Not like the burger you really.
Burger with a U. Help him get to 100K. He needs it.
Yeah, help me out. First off, thank you for inviting me onto your show. It's a real pleasure. I didn't actually get to tell you what job blew the most. Can I just say where it was?
Say it.
Sure.
I worked at the Gap in
retail. Yeah.
Whitman Mall. And I was, I didn't learn how to fold pants yet. And they put me in the folding department. These two old Yenta ladies realized that I couldn't fold for shit. So then they said, all right, you know, just vacuum the store. So I was vacuuming the Gap every night. Their soundtrack, you know, they had a good Gap soundtrack. And that was the job that blew the most.
I would.
All right.
Good. You're like, they're like, who's this woman folding jeans? You're like, you said fold jeans. I call my mother. She's here. Folding jeans.
All right.
See what I'm going to do. All right. Well, listen, so Jeremy Neuberger on Twitter, it's, in any other websites, you can give us a website.
Ironboundfilms.com.
Check out the documentaries, the punk band, the Jewish baseball team. That's so great. So much going on. Brianna, your handles.
Just at Bri Haswan on Instagram. We're at Jobs Below Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we also have our website, jobsbelowpodcast.com.
We're at I just said handles, like love handles with my love. At Mr. Josh Hyman, everything MRJOSHHYMAN. Check out the website because we now have it so that you can listen to all the episodes while just sitting on the website. You don't have to go over to Apple or any of the other streamers. You can if you want to. Either way, please review, subscribe, tell your friends, make suggestions. That's how we got Jeremy today on the show. And that's it. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate all of you for listening.
Bye.
I'm so tired. I don't know what to do. I'm so tired. Mind is set on you. I wonder, should I